Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
You didn't have to see Mike or his brother Tim or Karen the mom or yeah. Tom the dad in those meetings that I had to have with them, and I had to tell them what happened to their little girl, and I had to explain to them what the evidence is showing and sit through those meetings. You know, those meetings will remind you this is not a joke. This is not playtime.
That, of course, is the unmistakable voice of Mr. Ken Kratz, the villain of the Netflix documentary series Making a Murderer. He's the villain because he's the man who convinced a jury that Stephen Avery raped and murdered Teresa Hallback in Manitowoc County in 2005. Avery was in the midst of suing the county at the time because he'd been wrongfully convicted for a rape and attempted murder 20 years earlier, for which he'd spent 18 years in prison. It's an incredible story, without a doubt, but is the documentary a reasonable account of it? Or is it an unhelpfully biased piece of entertainment that left out important details? Well, have a listen to my conversation with Ken Kratz and then hit me up on Facebook and let me know what you think. I'm Michelle Laurie and this is the Nitty Gritty Committee, stories about the guts and the glory of life.
Hi, Michelle. How are you?
Oh, good, thanks. I'm a bit creeped out to hear your voice, to be honest. Sorry.
That's okay. Don't worry. It's nice to hear your voice, though. We'll talk about that.
Do you, as I was watching Making a Murderer, I had a moment, I think I even tweeted it, that's something about your voice, and then someone tweeted back to me, it's the voice that haunts my nightmares.
Because that's not good. We don't want nightmares. We don't want the voice haunting.
Well, because certainly from the perspective of the film and of the documentary series and the ladies who made it, you're the villain of the piece. You're the person who is deliberately subverting justice to put an innocent man in prison.
Right, and the documentary's done very well. It casts me and a couple other police officers as the villain, but I hope when people understand that only one side of the story was told, and when we're able to get out the other side, they'll realize exactly what the jury realized, and that this was not a product of planting evidence or some kind of a conspiracy, but the right person was convicted for the murder.
What is that information that you want to get out there? Because I've certainly heard the filmmakers interviewed, and they stand by the documentary series. They say that they presented the evidence as they saw it. And these are two cool women from New York who've gone and lived in the community for a year or two to try and really immerse themselves in the story. So they're standing by their version of events. What do you think they missed?
Well, what happened, Michelle, is they were embedded with the defense team. They were allowed unparalleled access to defense strategy sessions and everything with the defense. And so understanding that they are with the defense, this documentary is really made by and for the defense team. And when you realize that the editing has occurred, and they've what I've said is spoon-fed the audience selective pieces of evidence and not really represented what the state did to dispel the planting defense, then it really isn't fair to call it a documentary. Some of the examples that are clearest of this are the victim's phone and a camera were found about 20 feet from Stephen Avery's home. He burned them in a burn barrel that was on his property. Making a murderer never tells you that. They never tell you that the contents of her purse are all found there. And they don't tell you that because it's not consistent with the planting defense. You can't plant burned up electronics, at least the way that that they were found. It had to be burned right where they were found in that burn barrel.
Well, at the same time, though, somebody burned those materials.
Absolutely. Right.
What evidence is there to suggest that it was him?
For 4 hours. And so somebody burned them for 4 hours, 20 feet from his door. Now, he was seen by two different witnesses burning in that burn barrel the afternoon that Teresa was killed. And so it isn't that that alone means, you know, guilt or not guilt, but what we're talking about is the decision by the filmmakers to intentionally leave that information out. It's relevant. It's important information, as is DNA that's found on the victim's hood latch underneath her car. They completely leave out that information. They don't tell you that phone calls were made luring the victim to that particular location, or that ballistics testing shows that the bullet that was found in the garage matched the rifle fired by Stephen Avery, and it was fired from that gun before the 5th of November of 2005, when the officers had seized that weapon. So all of those things, Michelle, are just inconsistent with their narrative, and so they don't include them. They don't put that stuff in. You know, this documentary would have been just as entertaining, at least in my opinion, if they would have put both sides of it in, but it doesn't fit their conclusion that they want everybody to draw when they watch this, and that is that this man was framed, or that a miscarriage of justice has occurred. And so I've been doing my best since December 18th when this came out to remind people that you've only heard one side of it, that there's this whole other side that I've been trying to get some of the story out, but there's so much more to this story, and that probably leads us into my decision to write a book, and we'll talk about that when you're ready for that.
I'm really glad that you're writing a book, because this story is so strange that as a viewer, I'm just trying to apply some common sense to it. And I suppose that most viewers are. We're trying to figure out what's most likely to have happened, because it is such a strange story for a man to be proven to have been imprisoned when he was innocent for 18 years, and DNA evidence proved that he was not the rapist that he was accused of being. And then he wins a judgment against the county as a result of that, and the police who put him away the first time are called as witnesses and are accused of lying, and certainly the judgment in his favour would suggest that the court accepted that they had lied in his first case. These are the same individuals who 2 years after he is freed are trying to imprison him again for this murder. So when you just look at that list of things, you go, okay, well, common sense dictates that they are that this is revenge and that they're trying to put him away again. And if
all that happened, Michelle, I suppose that's true. But there was no judgment. There was a lawsuit that they filed. They claimed, Stephen Avery claimed that these officers had been intentionally imprisoning him. But at the time of the murder, that case was still pending. It was still open. So there wasn't any revenge motive. There was no judgment that had been issued at that point. And so
Certainly some reputations had been seriously sullied by that stage.
I agree. Yes, absolutely. I agree with that. However, the fact that their employer, that is the, if you're talking about the police, that the county of Manitowoc is being sued, neither of these officers that they've identified as having planted evidence were themselves being sued. They weren't going to lose a penny out of the process. And so the fact that their boss or their employer is being sued, you've got to be able to believe and reconcile that that would cause these police to find a 25-year-old photographer and kill her and chop her up and burn her and all of those things just to make this guy look bad. That's the other argument, isn't it?
That's the other side when we try to apply common sense to the other side, right, is the fact that a woman went to that property to perform her job, which was to photograph a car that was going to be listed for sale, and was never seen alive again. And in fact, her remains were found in a burn pit on that property. So again, the common sense from that perspective says, well, then he must have killed her. What else could possibly happen?
Yeah, not just on that property, but right behind his garage, his backyard. And so all of the evidence, at least that which was presented in the Avery case, pointed to Stephen Avery having been involved. My quarrel with the filmmakers was that it's irresponsible to leave things out or to edit clips so that they take valuable parts of the clip out, or not to present the state side. You know, I gave a closing argument in the case, and these two filmmakers sat through it. The centerpiece, or one of the centerpieces of my closing argument, was the DNA on the hood latch, and so they didn't have to guess what it was that I was going to say or complain that I wouldn't give them an interview afterwards and not present it. They knew what evidence was available that not only I had available, but I told the jury about. I told them, here's why this planting defense is nonsense. And to suggest that, you know, this is the same evidence that the jury heard, when the filmmakers make that suggestion to the audience, when that's not nearly the case, really is unfair. So to get the opportunity now in writing this book to set the matter straight, to tell the public the entire case of Stephen Avery, not just that which was omitted from the documentary, or not just that which the judge didn't allow in evidence, but there's this whole pile of information about Stephen Avery that's never before been talked about, never before been released, that when it is released, Michelle, you do read all the information and you realize that we had so much more that wasn't even presented. I hope you, just as the jury did, will be convinced that this man's right where he belongs.
Well, certainly the DNA evidence is important because, I mean, to my memory, the filmmakers chose not to include the DNA under the hood latch at all, did they?
No, they never mentioned it. And because it was such an important part of my argument, it's really difficult to believe them now when they say, well, we thought we put in the most important things, or we cut some evidence out just for purposes of time and things. This is a 10-hour documentary. They had plenty of time to put everything that we believed was important
into it.
And
that bit's crucial, isn't it? Because as a viewer, it was the DNA evidence inside the car and the idea that that had been planted, and they showed us their theory as to how that had been extracted by a police officer and that was a very convincing argument. So for them then to not go on to include, well, hang on, there was also DNA under the hood latch that can't have been planted there for these reasons, that was a crucial piece to leave out.
It was, and here's what happens, Michelle, and I don't know that people really understand that when a narrative is being told, when a story is being told in a certain way, eventually you're going to adopt or believe anyway that you couldn't tell the story by leaving out the entire other side, that nobody would be that irresponsible to do that. It would be so easy to refute and show the other side, but that's exactly what happened, Michelle. I'm not overstating this at all. And again, when the book is finished, which should be sometime around June of this year when it's released, then everybody will not only be able to look at the evidence that was omitted, but all of these other things. You know, we've got this, we've got the audio tapes and videotapes that are going to go along with the book that people are going to be able able to access on wow. on the internet and dig into this thing, those internet sleuths, you know, that
yes.
love to do that kind of stuff, which is really fascinating, and it's a compelling story, but we're going to give them that opportunity with all of the information to be able to satisfy that craving.
It's certainly a matter of public record now that that piece of crucial information was omitted from the documentary series. So that's then opened the gates to this idea that there is lots of stuff that we weren't aware of when we all made up our minds, we amateur sleuths. But I'm interested in what you're saying about things about Steve Avery coming out that hadn't come out before. That's particularly pertinent in our community here in Australia because we've had a number of high-profile, awful crimes committed in Australia in the past couple of years in particular, and then we find out that they were committed by men who we believe should have been in jail. Why are violent rapists and, you know, out walking the streets to escalate their activities and to murder women? There's an idea in Australia that for the community to know about these things is subverting justice and you know,
right.
is an assault on people's privacy and all that kind of stuff. So you're saying now that you have information that do you think the community should have known about Stephen Avery?
No, not at all. I have information that I chose not to introduce into evidence.
Right.
And so it is that information which was just too prejudicial to put in. But I'll tell you what, Michelle, when the defense, when the filmmakers, and when now the general public is claiming that our cops are crooked or that they're planting evidence or that the prosecutor, for goodness sakes, as if I had something to do with the case, was responsible for this man getting a miscarriage of justice. At that point, there's an old saying that the gloves come off, and
yep.
you have to present that evidence, which hasn't been revealed before, which I intend to do, and I suspect a lot of people are going to be very surprised by just what kind of evidence is available that shows that this man is very, very dangerous indeed.
Well, interestingly, Kathleen Zellner, who is Stephen Avery's current lawyer, has come out recently to say that not only does she believe that she can prove that there's reasonable doubt about his guilt, but she believes she can prove his innocence. What do you make
of that? I would love to see that. You know, Kathleen Zellner is she's very good at what she does, and whether it's fortunately or unfortunately, she doesn't shy away from media attention and putting things on Twitter and the like. And
which neither do you, in fairness.
I disagree.
Ken?
Well, right. So I said it may be good or it may be bad, Michelle. We'll have to reserve ruling on that. I guess who needs to be on the other side of that when you decide. But she's very, very good at what she does. She's a very good lawyer. She's gotten many people exonerated that have been wrongly convicted. I'll tell you what, though, Michelle, if she has something new, if she has the kind of evidence that it's going to be needed to not only win this man a new trial, but to have him exonerated for this case, it's going to have to be a bombshell. It's going to have to be dramatic indeed. I haven't heard of any such of evidence, and I guess I suppose like the rest of the world, together with my book, perhaps we'll wait for her what she's going to reveal.
In the process of writing the book, I mean, How is it felt to go and track back through this trial? Is there part of you that wants to put it behind you, or are you quite happy to go through it again?
Excuse me. No. In fact, I have made every attempt not to write a book. That might sound a little funny, but for 10 years now, I chose not to write a book, and it was only when the Netflix docudrama came out and somebody had to step up and say, you're not hearing the rest of the story. This is a misrepresentation. This isn't fair. Not only is the conviction being challenged, but really our entire justice system is on trial here. It's being indicted, and I wasn't going to sit back and stand for that. So I have dug out all my old files and all my old notes and the things that I kept that was able to prove to two different juries that both Mr. Avery and Mr. Dassey were responsible for this murder, and much of that together with other archived information is going to be used to complete complete the book. And as I've mentioned, I'm pretty confident that after reading it, you and everybody else is going to decide that a miscarriage of justice just did not occur here.
I'm looking very forward to reading it. Did you get a big advance? Surely any publisher worth their salt would have thought, I want Ken Kratz's book on my label and I'll pay him for it.
I wish I was allowed to talk about that, but I'm not. My book agent would be very angry with me, and you know, you might not want to go against me in court, but I know you don't want to go against him. So that's the.
I know I don't want to go against you.
I just have to smile and say, you know, it's going to be good. It's of course going to have all that information that people want. But like I said, for the true crime buffs that really want to dig into a case, want the raw materials, want the forensic reports and things like that, I'm going to do what I can to include all that on the internet. So all of that will be accessed from a code that you're going to be able to enter from the book. So it's really a tremendous multimedia project that we're hoping to release by sometime around June.
I mean, it's so exciting and salacious. It's hard sometimes to remember that the you are all real people that we're fascinated by, that Stephen Avery is in prison right now, his nephew Brendan Dassey is still in prison, and you have in fact received death threats over this case. Is that true?
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems. But getting therapy has its own problems too. Like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
It isn't even so much the death threats that that bother me. We've gotten over 4,000 email messages, most of which have been either critical, insulting, or some of which, of course, have been threatening. But they don't just threaten me; they threaten other members of my staff or my family. You know, when I get messages having people suggesting that they want to rape my daughter and have me have to watch it and really horrific kinds of things that they want to have happen, you have to wonder, are there any limits to this cyberbullying that goes on? When people want to express themselves, that's fine. If you don't like what I did, that's okay. If you want to make suggestions, that's okay too. But from a case that's over 10 years old, the prosecutor in the case to try to either put him out of business or to try to cause him harm or even to suggest bad things happen to his family goes well beyond the pale. And I really hope that in the future, at least sometime, that people do understand there are very real people on the other end of these things. And the Halbach family, you know, the victim's family, they've received perhaps not threats, but they've had to contend with the suggestion that the real killer is still out there or that Teresa's brother, Mike Halbach, is the real killer and all of these kind of things. And that's, you know, it's really hurtful. And I'm hoping that as much as people think that this is a game, or at least it's something that they're, you know, kind of allowed to do without limits, I wish they would reflect on it and understand that, again, there's some very real emotions and very real consequences that come to the people that you're suggesting have committed these offenses. So I'm glad that that we got to talk about that, because it's a real tragic part of this. You know, this case has so much to talk about from a way of the criminal justice system or some of the deficits or ways that we can improve it. And I really think that it's a tremendous example of media giving us the chance to do that. But it's really, I think, been wasted when it's gotten to be so personal and really in a tragic way somehow that we've lost the focus of this and gotten into, you know, mudslinging and those kind of things. So it's both good and bad. I think eventually things will settle down and people will look at this case like any other interesting murder case throughout history. But when you're, I guess, right in the middle of it and wrapped up around it, it may seem a little more acute than it would need to be.
Teresa Halbach's brother and also her ex-boyfriend are sort of the lightning rods for suspicion around other people and her family and stuff like that. And again, I can relate to it from an Australian's perspective because there's a very famous case in Australia where a woman, Lindy Chamberlain, was actually imprisoned for murdering her baby who had been taken by a wild dog, by a dingo. But the community turned on her because they felt as though in the first sort of media moments that she wasn't reacting the way they thought she should react. People used to say she didn't cry. I knew it when she wasn't crying. Something was weird. Something was going on. And so, yeah, that went all the way to her ending up in prison for murdering her baby. And she was eventually exonerated.
We know, right. Everybody in the world knows about that case and the tragedy that was. And I think it really shows when you get a Netflix account and you're able to watch a movie, that really doesn't mean that a law degree comes with it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay? So what you get to do is enjoy it and you get to watch it, but don't make the mistake that this is what was shown to the jury. Don't make a mistake that this is everything that happened in the case, and it might be a good time to reserve judgments on that until, until you realize it's not your decision. It's a decision of the jury that got to hear all of the evidence.
And that people in this incredibly stressful situation, like the brother of a missing woman and the ex-boyfriend, still very friendly, of a missing woman, you know, it's this assumption that we know how they should behave in that situation. And certainly when I saw Teresa's brother and her friend reacting, I was a bit taken aback by their reactions. But then I think, well, I don't know how I would feel or how I would cope in those days when she's missing. And then I find out she's murdered.
And you also don't know how it was edited and how you got to, you know, it's presented exactly what they wanted you to see. And you've got to understand that because this is not a representation of what the family was acting like. You didn't have to see Mike or his brother Tim or Karen the mom or Tom the dad in those meetings that I had to have with them. And I had to tell them what happened to their little girl. And I had to explain to them what the evidence is showing and sit through those meetings. You know, those meetings will remind you, this is not a joke. This is not playtime. These are the times that that you have these people that are absolutely without hope and that are crushed. And to somehow think that you can look at somebody's face because they smiled when you think that they should have been frowning, or because they, you know, maybe have giggled in a nervous way when perhaps it was somewhat not a responsible thing at the time to do. You don't know how they're dealing with stress or testimony or all of those things. People do react very, very differently, and I really hope that people wouldn't base their decision on how people look. You know, we're told, jurors are told, you don't look at somebody and decide if they're guilty or not guilty. You hear all the time, well, you know, he looks like a rapist or he looks like a child molester or something like that, which is totally unfair to the other side. We wouldn't get away with that. We wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't be able to go in front of a jury and say, well, just look at him. He looks guilty. So why the other side thinks that it's appropriate with no evidence at all, with nothing but speculation or nothing but a documentary to point going to make those suggestions. You know, it's a very serious, or should be, a very serious thing to claim that somebody committed murder, especially against a family member. And I think it's irresponsible to just do that because he happened to be shown in the movie.
The other side has a lot of celebrity clout behind it too. The other side from yours, I mean. Ellen DeGeneres, Alec Baldwin, lots of celebrities have come forward in support of Stephen Avery. Do you have any celebrities coming forward to give you their support?
Look, they've got me, Michelle. And so that's all they need. You know what I've, in all fairness, what I've always said is, you can have all the celebrities. You give me the facts,
yeah,
and you let me present the facts and the evidence to a jury. Those are the people I have to convince. I don't have to convince a movie audience about what happened. I've already convinced the 12 people that I have to convince, and I can live with that.
Jodie Stokowski, very controversial figure most recently. She was Stephen Avery's girlfriend at the time of the murder. In the documentary series, completely supportive of him, recently has come out and said, actually, I was terrified of him. He physically abused me and he told me what to say and I was too afraid of him not to say it. Were you in contact with her at any point during the trial, or were you aware?
Yes.
Right.
Both before the trial and during, we were aware of Jodie's fear of Stephen Avery. And so the suggestion that just now she's coming forward with this is not true at all.
Okay.
We had that information back then. In fact, there are all of these phone calls between Stephen and Jodie where Stephen is extremely explosive, where he is threatening to Jodie and really not a very nice guy. Certainly the documentary is not going to show you that because they want to paint him as a pussycat, a mild-mannered guy, rather than being sadistic and beating up his wives and his girlfriends and every other woman basically that he's ever come in contact
with. Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because in the documentary,
a surprise at all.
In the documentary, they definitely do show the letters that he sent to his first wife from his first stint in prison that were threatening and violent. And they also made mention of him setting a cat alight. And in both of those cases, it was sort of glossed over. The cat incident was described as a silly mistake that a young man makes. And the tormenting and threatening of the wife was described as a sort of broken-hearted dad in jail who's having his children kept from him.
Sure. Let me talk about both of those things. You know, the description, first of all, the movie makers allowed either Stephen or his lawyers to talk about his prior record. When you notice who is on camera talking about them, it isn't any police officer. It's not a victim. It's not some prosecutor. It's either Stephen or the lawyers. And so, when Stephen soaked his cat in gasoline and oil and put it on a fire, you know, that's bad enough. But when you realize, Michelle, that the cat jumped off the fire and was running around the yard on fire, and what Stephen did then is he picked up the cat and put it back on the fire so he could watch it suffer some more. Yeah. This is the Stephen Avery that we're talking about. This is the Stephen Avery different than he claims, well, I was hanging around with the wrong crowd or with the people, you know.
Yeah.
This isn't hanging around with wrong crowds. This is sadistic. This is the precursor to individuals murdering humans. You read about it all the time, the abuse of animals, how that is very diagnostic of these serial killers and other kind of killers. So there isn't anything surprising about that. And to suggest for his wife all of these specific threats of what he's going to do to her, you know, she was scared to death. The attorneys say it's all about Stephen's kids, and you know, Stephen wanted to see his kids. And what they don't tell you is that the judge ordered a restraining order. You're going to stay away from these kids because of the kind of person you are, because of how dangerous and violent you are. So Stephen Avery, you're not entitled to be around these people because of your violent nature and the threats that you've made to kill and hurt people, and not to give the attention that that deserves, because certainly domestic violence and everything else needs that that kind of attention. And for especially, and I don't mean to be sexist, but for his female prior lawyer to say, well, you know, it wasn't that big a deal, or remember when he ran that that woman off, saying, well, because it's only because she was a relative, and they minimized what she did to provoke him. You know, are you kidding me, Michelle? Yeah. I mean, nobody would be able to get away with that kind of victim blaming after the fact, but because they put it into a movie, somehow it's accepted. It's irresponsible. It is absolutely inappropriate to talk about victims of domestic violence in that way, and I think it was deplorable.
Yeah, certainly Stephen's son, Stephen Avery Jr., has spoken in the last day or two about his sad belief that his dad did murder Teresa, what's her last name, Halibach? How do I say Teresa's last name?
Halbach,
that's right. Yeah, so he's come forward and said that he sadly does believe that his dad is guilty of the murder of Teresa Halbach. So this is the child.
What a sad, you know, what a sad thing for a kid to have to say. And you know, I don't mean to be an apologist at all for the Avery family, but you know, how horrible for the media to be really hounding these people. You know, what you don't see at the trial, the very first thing I said to the media after the trial was over is that there's two families here that have really suffered a loss. It isn't just the Halbachs, but it's the Avery family as well. And of course, they didn't want to give me any kind of humanity, but I asked them to please remember that, and please, which the Halbachs were certainly aware of. You know, one of the stories that will be in the book after the verdict was read, when I met with the Halbach and about 50 supporters, we prayed. We went into a conference room and we prayed. But we prayed for the Averys. We prayed for the pain and all of the disappointments and all of the things that they were going through as well. And I hope that it's those kind of stories that people understand just how good this family was, and just how much we tried to not only do the right thing, but to put things in perspective, and to realize that two families were very, very hurt by this really tragic event.
Well, a couple of members of the Avery family were, you know, were treated very. What's the word I'm looking for? Sorry, I'm tired. I've been up for a long time. a couple of the members of the Avery family came into sharp focus in the documentary series in a very sympathetic way. One, of course, is Stephen's mum, but also his sister, who is the mother of Stephen's co-accused, Brendan Dassey. Now, this woman we see grapple with the idea that her son could have been involved, that her brother could have involved her son. Then her son turns to her and says, no, actually, I didn't see anything. I wasn't involved. I just said that. And for much of the process, it seems like she's just trying to get out of her own son. Is he guilty or not? Is he involved in this or not? And this kid has a low IQ, and we're really baffled as to what his involvement really is. But certainly he's been in jail for 16 years. What do you think about it?
Well, you shouldn't be baffled at all, because when you watch the entire 3.5 hours of his confession, you will realize that the things that he says and the way he says them could only be said by somebody who was involved in the rape, in the murder, and in the dismemberment of this girl. And so we're back to the editing and choosing what it is that you're going to watch. You know, the filmmakers don't show you all of the times when the officers intentionally suggested things that they know didn't happen. And they do that as kind of a control. And what Brendan then does is he rejects that. He says, look, that didn't happen. Right. It didn't happen that way. So when it doesn't happen, Brendan's able to stand up to them, and he's able to say that's not the way it happened. But when the officers are asking for the truth, and when Brendan does finally have to admit some really personal and some really unattractive behaviors, He's reluctant to do that, but he should be reluctant to do that. These are serious allegations. These are serious behaviors from this young man. He told his mom on several occasions that he was involved. He might have said, I only did some of it or things like that. But you know what? If you're there and if you're helping and you did some of those things later, you can't say, well, by the way, I made the whole thing up. You know what I mean? There's no reason with your mother, especially, to feel intimidated or to feel that that you're being coerced into saying things. And so when you kind of put common sense back involved in the equation, it's pretty obvious that this young man was involved. The real tragedy, though, Michelle, about Brendan is not so much what he was involved in, but the fact that it was his own family that had talked him out of taking the plea deal, the plea bargain. He could have been out in 15 years. In fact, 7 years from now, he could have been released. But it was his family, not his lawyers, his family that told him, don't take the plea deal, Brendan, because it's going to hurt Stephen's case. Just think of that. Think of how you're being sacrificed for somebody else's case. You know, it's no wonder that now he's sitting in prison thinking, well, tell me again how that benefited me. Tell me again why I shouldn't have gotten a life and been able to get out in a relatively short period of time because it was going to help my uncle's case. That's such a real tragedy and disservice to do for a young man, especially one that's relying on those family members for good, sound advice. And you'd hope that those family members would be thinking of his interests and not either their own interests or the interests of the uncle who's sitting in prison. My book will go into much of that, much detail about the efforts made by the family members to talk him out of that plea bargain and how it was that it was the family members, I think, which caused this real tragedy, and that's this man, really this young man, having to spend the rest of his life in prison.
Ken Kratz there discussing the case of Stephen Avery. I don't know about you, but I found him much more pleasant than I expected to from watching the series. I was totally sucked into his villainhood in the series, but I enjoyed our conversation, and I plan to catch up with him again when his book is released. And I'm looking very forward to reading the book. Don't forget to hit me up on Facebook if you'd like to suggest other guests, perhaps, or tell me your thoughts about the Avery case, about the Kratz conversation, or anything else. I'm Michelle Laurie. Thanks so much for downloading.
Mamma Mia Out Loud. It's the weekly podcast with what everyone's talking about. From politics...
He's probably the smartest politician.
Get on with it, Malcolm.
...to pop culture, Amy Schumer and me.
This is what they'd probably refer to as the walk of shame, where you've just really cocked that one up.
And everything in between.
We've got the questions on Ramadan, dum-ga-ding-dum.
Please explain.
It's like listening in on a conversation with your friends.
When we were trying to have sex and we looked over and he was standing up waving a sock at us.
You're smart friends.
The thing about politics is it can be played very easily. They're what politicians will call announceables, make things look really good.
You're silly friends.
This is the most ridiculous conversation we've ever had.
You're occasionally nude friends.
God, everyone, Mia's naked.
Oh my God.
Ah!
I feel free.
I'm crying right now.
No, I'm laughing.
Mamma Mia!
It's out every Wednesday. Subscribe in iTunes or your favourite podcast app.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavourless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello? Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.